Good morning. I'm in the garden today. The news agenda moves on relatively quickly, and if you can remember back as far as last Sunday and through the first part of the week, the Prime Minister's advisor, Dominic Cummings, was being tried and found guilty on Twitter for us all to see and hear. There was almost universal hostility in the kind of London-centred world of the media, perhaps a slightly more measured and divided reaction in the rest of the country, but a lot of hostility to go around. And when he finally spoke for himself, his words satisfied some and left others even more determined to get rid of him, as we've seen since then, even if things have now slightly moved on. They'll be back for him sooner or later, no doubt. There are a lot of differences between Dominic Cummings and Jesus, as Cummings himself would certainly acknowledge. But perhaps there are rather fewer differences between the thought police and the crowds in today's London and yesterday's Jerusalem. We're back in John's Gospel this morning, thinking about Jesus and listening to Jesus speaking and learning from Jesus' teaching, finding out how best to respond to Jesus. We're picking up the story where we left it last week in chapter 7 of John's Gospel. We're in the middle of a big festival, a national annual feast, the Feast of Tabernacles, an annual celebration of God's kindness centuries earlier when he rescued his people from tyranny. And today's section ends with a challenge from Jesus to make a right judgment, a proper assessment of him and of ourselves and of our response to him. We're going to focus on a couple of questions. There's a question the people listening to Jesus were asking each other about Jesus. And then a question that Jesus asks the crowd about themselves. And then we'll respond to the conclusion that Jesus draws. So question one, where did Jesus get his learning? And that's in verse 15. And then question two, this one from Jesus, why are you trying to kill me? And then the conclusion that Jesus draws, the invitation that he issues, which is make a right judgment. In a sense, it's a command, not simply an invitation. And that comes in verse 24. So off we go with question one. Where did Jesus get his learning? Look in verse 15 with me. The Jews there were amazed and asked, how did this man get such learning without having been taught? Back in chapter 5, when Jesus was last in the temple courts, he healed a man who was lame. But because Jesus did the healing on the Sabbath and referred to God as his father, the Jewish leaders were determined to kill him. So it took considerable courage for Jesus to go back to the same place, back to the temple courts with the same audience, to teach openly in the face of such murderous hostility. But even as Jesus was teaching, and we might say even among the religious leaders as he was teaching, there was a kind of grudging recognition of his profound learning, his wisdom, his understanding, his ability, and his authority. I think we could say with a degree of fairness, our own cultural leaders are far slower to give Jesus even this kind of reluctant acknowledgement that his teaching is profound and full of understanding and wisdom. Our thought police today, whether they're stand-up comedians or cultural commentators or people of the kind of Twitterati classes, most of them give the impression that Jesus didn't actually say anything that was worth hearing or taking seriously, nothing worth considering today. But what bothered them back in Jerusalem was not simply his learning, but how he could be so filled with learning without having been to any of the relevant rabbinical theological colleges. How could Jesus have learned so much without being taught by any of them? Well, look at verse 16 for his answer. Jesus answered, "My teaching is not my own. It comes from the one who sent me." Where did Jesus learn his wisdom? Well, he sat under a teacher, and his father was his teacher. God the Father has been his teacher from his earliest days. The source of his learning is God himself. Jesus has heard his father and watched his father, and Jesus has learned to obey and imitate his father. Last time Jesus was there in the temple, he said to them then, and I quote, "The Son can do nothing by himself. He can do only what he sees his father doing." That's John 5, verse 19. And later in the story, in the next chapter, Jesus will insist again, "He who sent me is trustworthy, and what I have heard from him, I tell the world." That's John 8, verse 26. And again, "I do nothing on my own, but speak just what the Father has taught me." That's John 8, verse 28. Now, we know that what Jesus is saying is true, and that his learning, his spiritual wisdom, comes from God the Father. It's directly from the Father. And Jesus says how we can know that to be true in verse 17. He says, "Anyone who chooses to do the will of God will find out whether my teaching comes from God or whether I speak on my own." We can't prove that Jesus is from God in a court of law or by consulting a panel of scientists, but we can prove it in our experience. Imagine for a moment that you were lost on a mountain and you asked for directions. How would you know that what you heard in the directions was true? Well, you'd follow the directions and soon find out. Then you would know. If the person giving directions said, "Go over that hillside, turn right and turn right and turn right again, and you'll be back to where you started." Well, the teaching of Jesus is like those instructions, bringing us back to the path, leading us out of darkness, lighting the way, leading us through life and bringing us home. And we know that his teaching is from God as we commit ourselves to discovering and doing God's will through Jesus. But Jesus goes further. He not only clarifies the source of his teaching and how we can know that his teaching comes from the Father, he underlines his motives as he speaks and his integrity as a speaker, as a character. Look in verse 18. Jesus says, "Whoever speaks on their own does it to gain personal glory. But he who seeks the glory of the one who sent him is a man of truth. There is nothing false about him." He wants to know that whenever he speaks for the glory of God. His voice is unlike so many of the other voices clamoring for attention in Jerusalem back then and in London today. Jesus can say of himself what nobody else can ever say. There is nothing false about him. He speaks the truth. He's a man of truth. There's nothing false in him. Nothing false ever comes from him. Jesus never had to apologize to anybody for anything he ever said. Think about that for a moment. He spoke the truth and the whole truth and nothing but the truth. We often need to say, "Look, I'm sorry, that wasn't quite accurate," or "I didn't tell you the whole story," or "I'm afraid I misled you, I didn't mean to," or "Actually, I did mislead you deliberately." Jesus is a man of truth, nothing false about him, speaking truth that he's learned from God the Father. And isn't that a great relief? In a world of fake news and lies and distortion and propaganda, personal agendas all over the place, whenever Jesus speaks, he tells the truth. Whatever Jesus says can be trusted. And that Jesus makes so much sense when he speaks because he'd been taught by God the Father himself. Now, what's surprising to us is that even though they were grudgingly prepared to acknowledge his learning, the religious leaders were absolutely determined to get rid of Jesus. Not simply to send him back up north to a life of obscurity among the fishermen in Galilee, they were determined to murder him. Well, that brings us to our second question for this morning. And this time it's a question from Jesus for the crowds and the religious leaders. And it's this: why are you trying to kill me? So question two, why are you trying to kill me? And that comes in verse 19. Look at verse 19 with me. "Has not Moses given you the law?" asks Jesus. "Yet not one of you keeps the law. Why are you trying to kill me?" Jesus is making the point that plotting his murder certainly turns these religious leaders into lawbreakers. They couldn't see that plotting murder as an expression of their commitment to law-keeping was absolutely certainly law-breaking. And at this point, the crowd is just as hostile towards Jesus as the religious leaders. The crowd accuses Jesus of sorcery. And Jesus responds to the rejection of the crowd, and he challenges the routine decisions of both the crowd and the religious leaders as an expression of their superficiality and inconsistency in their thinking. Let's see how he does that together for a moment. The language is unfamiliar, but actually I think we'll get his point relatively straightforwardly. Look in verse 21. Jesus said to them, "I did one miracle and you are all amazed." He's looking back to chapter 5 where he healed the man who was lame. And now Jesus explores, in the light of that, what was happening routinely on the Sabbath. They criticized him for Sabbath breaking, for healing on the Sabbath. But routinely in the temple, festivals sometimes come first. To observe the festival, the Jews sometimes had to override the routine regulations for an ordinary Sabbath. Circumcision sometimes came first. To circumcise a boy on the eighth day, circumcisions were sometimes carried out on the Sabbath. Everybody knew that, and nobody had a problem with it. And now watch how Jesus explores that with them. And then he comes back to his question again. So verse 22, yet he says, because Moses gave you circumcision, though actually did not come from Moses, but from the patriarchs, you circumcise a boy on the Sabbath. Now, if a boy can be circumcised on the Sabbath, so that the law of Moses may not be broken, why are you angry with me for healing a man's whole body on the Sabbath? Do you see what Jesus is saying? If it's okay to suspend the Sabbath for a tiny piece of minor surgery on a small part of a little boy's anatomy, then how much more must it also be okay to suspend the Sabbath for the restoration of a man's whole body, especially when God himself shows his approval by providing the power to restore the man's whole body to health? It's an argument from the smaller to the greater. Do you see also what Jesus is asking in verse 23? Why are you angry? Well, what's your answer to his question? Why do you think they are so angry when they've recently seen Jesus making a lame man walk for the first time? And as we're thinking about that, look closely at Jesus as this little episode brings Jesus so sharply into focus. Choose what strikes you about him as you gaze at him in this scene. Here is a man of astonishing courage. Here is a man teaching openly in the temple courts where he knows that they are already plotting to murder him. Here is a man of learning, even as his enemies grudgingly admit. Here's a man who testifies that his teaching comes directly from God. He promises that anyone can know his teaching is truly from God if they'll commit themselves to responding to his teaching. And his overall goal is the glory of God, not his own reputation. And he testifies to his own integrity as a man of truth, who can be trusted, who never misleads, a man who brings life and healing. And then look at what today's little episode reveals about ourselves. It's a passage a bit like a mirror in which we can see ourselves, not just the hearts of those who are there. The Jewish leaders and the crowds know that Jesus teaches with astonishing understanding, but they're not willing to listen to him and not willing to obey him. They'd rather get rid of him finally. They doubt the source of his authority. They call white black. They're furious with him for exposing the kind of superficiality of their assessment of him and revealing the hypocrisy of their own self-assessment. And Jesus could have walked away from them at that point for his own security, to escape from their murderous anger. Instead, he invites them to think again, to step away from superficiality, to step away from inconsistency and hypocrisy, to leave behind their hostility towards him. Look at his final invitation to them. He invites them to make a right judgment. And verse 24 invites us to a deeper relationship with God through Jesus, to a greater self-awareness and a proper response to Jesus. Look at verse 24 with me. He says, stop judging by mere appearances, but instead judge correctly. And so here's Jesus inviting us today to listen carefully to him, not to respond to him superficially, not to make judgments about him that are hasty. And here's Jesus inviting us to think again about ourselves, not to be certain too easily that we are as good as we like to think we are, or to suggest to others that we are. And as we learn to judge correctly, we'll begin to see more fully our need for God's forgiveness. And we'll see more clearly why Jesus came to die on the cross. That's where he's heading, to pay the price of our forgiveness. And we'll look to Jesus to guide us through life, through the anxieties of the current situation, and through death, as a man of truth, in whom there is no falsehood, whose every word can be trusted. And as we commit ourselves to do the will of God in listening to Jesus and obeying his teaching, we'll grow in our certainty that Jesus is truly from God, and that he is precisely who he says he is, and that his death on the cross is our sure and certain hope, but our only hope for God's forgiveness. So make a right judgment about Jesus, about ourselves, and about our response to him. Amen.